Oh, when a number tells a story and when it leads to an investigation. The Texas Education Agency says some numbers are not adding up. Next on The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
Red State Blues. Sounds like a song, but it's a thorough analysis on how red are red state policies. We'll be talking to the directors of Confession Killer, the docu-series that has Texas written all over it. The challenges aging parents face when caring for an adult child with mental illness. And let's talk about power. Geothermal power in an initiative by UT Austin. All of these stories and more. This is the Texas Standard. It is the last Friday of the year. This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. And we are living that moment when one year is coming to an end. Quickly, slowly, depending on your perspective. And even if 2019 was your best year yet, we dream. Dare I say, we believe that 2020 might, will be better. Thinking about the decade that was, even I was surprised at how much of the Texas story informed it. From the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, to Hurricane Harvey, to immigration, to Simone Biles, to wind energy, to initially having two Democratic presidential contenders, Texas has been all over the news. Now, the Texas Education Agency, or TEA, is investigating 12 Texas school districts that reported last year a huge number of their high school graduates were planning to enlist in the military. So what's the big deal with that? Well, a school's academic performance ratings can be drastically boosted if they have a high number of students planning to enlist in the military before high school graduation. Jacob Carpenter is an education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jacob, thanks for joining The Standard today.
Thanks for having me.
Can we start from the beginning? How can schools receive higher academic performance ratings or accountability ratings if they have a higher number of students planning to enlist?
So Texas has what is called an academic accountability system that takes a whole bunch of factors into play, many of which center around standardized test scores, but part of which also looks at how prepared are students for life after high school. One of the factors that they look at is how many of your students enlisted or plan to enlist in the military. And so the way that the system is set up, even though it's complex, it basically boils down to if you have a huge number of graduates who plan to enlist in the military, it can take your rating from, and Texas has an A through F system, it can take your rating from a D or an F all the way up to a B grade.
Oh, wow. Is that what happened to these 12 school districts that are under investigation?
So some of them, there are probably four of the 12 districts that in all likelihood, it's hard for us to calculate without having the raw data, but they likely would have been D or F districts. But because of this high military rating, keeping in mind the state average was about 4%.
Right.
These districts were reporting 30, 40, 50, in one case, 100% of graduates were enlisting.
So, Jacob, which districts are we talking about?
So there are 12 pretty small districts. They range from about 100 students to about 4,500 students, mostly rural, spread around the state.
One of the things that I was thinking, I don't know if you know this, but I'm a former high school teacher. And one of the things that I was thinking is that in some districts, that's not unusual. You know, when there are no other options for employment, when there's a high tradition of military in the family, you know, it's not unusual for the family to continue with that tradition. So what rang the alarm, let's say?
Sure. And that's part of what the state will be investigating is there could be very real and very accurate reasons for why some of these numbers are so high. There are two big red flags, though, that have jumped out. One is that essentially the districts are looking at how many plan to enlist. They don't actually get any data to show how many did enlist. Mm-hmm. And so we are able to see in some counties, very, very few people enlisted throughout the entire county, whereas the districts were reporting that they were having dozens and dozens of kids that were planning to enlist. And so there's a disconnect there. And the other side of it being that some districts used, and really what a lot of this comes down to, is that the state gave districts some discretion over how to classify a student as planning to enlist, and some used really loose methods of calculating that, and have even said, we're no longer going to do that.
Well, loose such as what? Just saying in passing, I'm planning to enlist?
Yeah, in one case, there was a district that essentially had a recruiter from the military come in and speak to students at the high school, and anybody who signed in to listen to that recruiter was classified as planning to enlist.
Oh, I see.
That happened in Kingsville ISD and Corpus Christi, and that principal is no longer there, and they are now planning to make big changes around that.
I'm curious, because this is a rule that TEA established, do you sense that it may change it in the future?
Yes, what the TEA is trying to do is get data from the Department of Defense to actually see who did enlist. They've tried but haven't been able to reach an agreement with the Department of Defense to get that data in the past, but they're hopeful to have something in place for 2020.
And can you tell me what happens next in the investigation?
Sure. There's what's called a special accreditation investigation, which is going on, and these happen all across the state for a variety of reasons. And essentially what will happen is the TEA will send its investigators in, they will conduct their interviews, gather their documents, and at the end, they will issue a ruling on essentially whether there is enough evidence to substantiate an allegation that that they circumnavigated this accountability system. In all likelihood, there's not going to be major sanctions against a district to the point where, you know, the state takes it over or anything like that, like we're seeing in Houston ISD. But there is one district that has already been under a lot of state scrutiny in Hearn ISD near College Station that could face major consequences. But it remains to be seen how much the TEA brings the hammer down on any districts that they feel like have manipulated the system, especially when you want to set a precedent to make sure that other districts don't do this.
Very interesting. Jacob Carpenter is a K-12 education reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Jacob, thank you for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
Radio host Chris Salcedo says justices of the peace in Texas are being asked to choose between giving up their careers or violate their religious beliefs by performing same-sex marriages. Joining us again in the studio, Madeline Meckelberg of PolitiFact Texas, based at the Austin American Statesman. Madeline, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Ready to fact check.
Yes, let's do this. So tell me more about this claim.
So this was during an interview that Salcedo had with Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, talking about a pretty high-profile case of a Waco Justice of the Peace who was sanctioned by a state commission earlier this month for only officiating opposite-sex marriages and not officiating same-sex marriages. And Salcedo was talking about this case, and he described her circumstances, and he said it in a way that needed a little bit of fact-checking. So I believe we've got audio of that exchange.
Perfect.
They would basically say, hey, look, the rules were changed on me midstream. I shouldn't have to give up my career, make a choice, either give up your career or violate your religious beliefs. The government shouldn't put me in that position.
Okay, so he talks about her having to give up her career. Is that something that actually could happen now that she's been sanctioned?
So the state commission sanctioned this justice of the peace. Her name's Diane Hensley, again from Waco, and she has a few options at this point. She's allowed to appeal the sanction, and that would allow her to avoid these harsher penalties, which could involve being removed from her post. But she can also change her behavior and fit the confines of this sanction that they're outlining. So that means that she can start performing same-sex marriages, offering them the same way she offers opposite-sex marriages, or she can stop performing marriages altogether. Because the concern that the State Commission had was that Hensley's actions could cast doubt on her capacity to act impartially on cases before her court in the future where someone's sexual orientation might come into play.
And actually, a justice of the peace does not have to perform marriages, right?
That's right. So justices of the peace handle, they tend to handle these lower-level civil and criminal cases cases like traffic violations and other misdemeanors, but they can also officiate marriages as an extrajudicial activity.
Like a job on the side.
Exactly. And they do get a little bit of extra income from that. It can go up to thousands of dollars. And so there's this financial incentive, certainly, to perform these ceremonies, but there is no requirement. It's not part of the job description.
So if it's not something that she has to do, what's the issue here? Why wouldn't she just stop performing marriages and just lift the sanction?
Right. So she argued that she is entitled to a religious exemption in this case because she does not believe in same-sex marriage because of her religious beliefs.
And is she?
Well, in reality, when we look at the laws in Texas, there are no laws, there are no legal precedents that establish this exemption in this specific case for a justice of the peace who optionally performs marriage ceremonies. There are actually only two pieces of legal documentation in Texas that kind of speak to this. Mm-hmm. One of them is the sanction from the State Commission that describes Hensley's situation, and the other is a 2015 opinion by Ken Paxton that was filed in the Supreme Court case that legalized gay marriage. But neither of those documents speak directly to this issue and this circumstance. And even if they did, they're not legally binding documents, so they don't dictate what happens in this case.
I understand. Okay, so how did PolitiFact Texas rate this?
So when we look at this case, the way we interpreted it was that no one is asking this justice to give up her career mm-hmm. or violate her religious beliefs. Neither of those things are on the table. So we rated this claim false.
False. Okay. Madeline Meckelberg with PolitiFact Texas at the Austin American Statesman. Thank you so much for being here, Madeline.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Happy holidays.
You too.
Michael Marks is in for Wells Dunbar, our social media editor. How are you, Michael?
I'm great. How you doing, Joy?
Doing good. The year is winding down, but our listeners are still writing to
That's
us.
That's right. That's right. They are. This is the season of gift giving, and yes. One Texan received quite a present yesterday afternoon. Spring's own Simone Biles named 2019 Female Athlete of the Year by the Associated Press.
Yeah. Well, she's been everywhere during the last decade.
Deservedly
not just,
so, yeah. Yeah. The second time she's actually won this award, and that's impressive. But as Twitter user Houston Dance Posse points out, that makes her the first gymnast to do it in a non-Olympic year.
Of course, wow.
Mm-hmm. No Olympics this year, but Biles did compete in the Gymnastics World Championships, where she picked up 5 gold medals. We'll get to what folks are thinking about this big achievement, as well as maybe some predictions for the new year when I come back at the end of the show.
I love that. So if you haven't reached out, do so.
Let us know. Twitter, Facebook, etc.
Yep.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with small and mid-sized companies by helping to unify their businesses and achieve digital transformation. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
It's business and your money on the Standard. I'm Joy Diaz. Wind and solar power are the fastest growing sources of electricity generation. Geothermal power also provides clean, climate-friendly energy, but its growth has lagged. There's an initiative from UT Austin that could change that. And as KUT's Mose Bushell reports, the school is looking for help in some unlikely places.
It's called the Geothermal Entrepreneurship Organization. Its goal is to quickly commercialize advances in geothermal technology by pairing researchers with oil and gas companies. Jamie Beard is the executive director of the group. She says traditionally, oil companies haven't had much incentive to invest in geothermal. But now that they're branching off into other forms of renewable energy development, geothermal is a natural fit.
Major oil and gas companies and oil service providers actually hold most of the expertise, and they also own the intellectual property on most really cutting-edge drilling technologies that would drive down costs for drilling very deep and very hot geothermal wells.
The organization, run at UT's Cockrell School of Engineering, will be funded with a $1 million grant from the U.S. Department of Energy.
I'm Mose Bushell for the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. The first lines of the new book, Red State Blues, by Matt Grossman, go like this. Over the past quarter century, an increasingly conservative Republican Party has made unprecedented gains at the state level, winning control of 24 new state governments. But what has the Republican Revolution in the states achieved? It's a very interesting premise for us in Texas. Matt Grossman is director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and senior fellow at the Niskanen Center. And I want to welcome you to the Texas Standard, Matt.
Good to be with you.
So tell me, what has this revolution achieved?
Well, there has been a large electoral change. Republicans went from controlling only three states in the early 90s to 27, controlling the House, Senate, and governorship in those states. And some of those changes look like they will be relatively permanent, such as throughout the wider American South. In policy terms, they have made less of a dent. They haven't really reversed the rise in the size and scope of state governments over that same period. The median state spending has doubled, even controlling for inflation. And they have gotten to a point where they're passing about as many conservative as liberal laws per year, but they haven't sort of reversed the buildup of past liberal laws.
I think our state is an interesting case study. How do you see Texas?
Well, on the electoral side, it has seen the same trends in kind of the broader South. People may think of the South as a very Republican area at this point, but it's not the case that that Democrats are out of contention in the South. Now, the big pattern in American politics is that midterm elections go against the party of the president, and what that means is that Republican gains in the states came overwhelmingly in the 1994 and 2010 elections, and to some extent in the 2014 elections. And Democrats came out in 2018 to continue that pattern, and that meant that lots of places were moving blue under the Trump presidency.
But is it just a response to the Trump presidency, or are Democrats, and some may say, gaining ground precisely because of what you were talking about, that the conservative brand of the Republican Party has not made the gains that it wanted to make?
Well, it takes a lot to break through for state-specific politics to matter in our nationalized era. For example, you know, how you feel about your state government has some minor role in how you vote for state legislature, but it is overwhelmed by how you feel about the president, even though, you know, state legislators don't have a whole lot to do with what's going on in Washington. Democratic state legislators were still punished under President Obama, and Republican state legislators are still being punished under Trump. Now, there are state politics considerations that do break through. We saw that recently with Medicaid spending. So it's certainly 14 states have not expanded Medicaid, and that is a big effect
of
Republican, Republican gains. On the other hand, Medicaid expansion is extremely popular basically everywhere that it's been put on the ballot. And so when Republican governors try to push back against it, it hasn't been very popular.
What did you hope to achieve with your book? Is it sort of telling the conservative Republican Party, this is what you're not doing right, this is what you should reconsider? Or what was your hope with this book?
Well, first of all, I do think it's useful to just look at the big trends to say, you know, we have these big electoral moves. They're very rare that one party would gain so much nationally, and they don't necessarily go along with real policy change. On the one hand, I think that's something that conservatives know already. That is, they know that most policy trends are liberal and that they are not able to completely reverse them. But I do think, you know, it should be some block on the idea that there's going to be some kind of conservative revolution at some point that pairs back the growth of government or reverses social trends, that those are kind of unachievable goals. But I think, you know, there are also lessons for liberals, first of all, that some trends in political life go their way regardless of who is in power. So every state is currently working to expand early childhood education. And we saw pretty large revolutions in gay rights and in drug policy, for example, over the same period of Republican gains. So there are, in some sense, some trends for liberals that might take a while, but do tend to go in their direction. Mm-hmm. The other big side, which we haven't talked about as much, is the actual effects of these policies.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the big lesson is that we should not expect as big of effects as we sometimes hear about in campaigns. And I do dwell a lot on the sort of Texas versus California comparison. That is,
right.
it's pretty easy for commentators to say, look at all these things about Texas, or look at all these outcomes in California. They must be responsive to, you know, the way the state government is pursuing its policies. But obviously, there are hundreds of other things different about those states.
Right.
And it turns out that when you try
incomes,
to account
population,
for...
Incomes, population, yeah.
Yeah. When you try to account for even the most basic differences between the states, what you find is that policy just has a whole lot less influence than it initially looks to be apparent. So most of those differences are not a product of which party controls government or which policies they pass.
Matt Grossman is director of the Institute for Public Policy and Social Research at Michigan State University and senior fellow at the Niskanen Center. Thank you so much for being with us, Matt.
Thank you.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, a statewide network of physicians treating more than 50,000 new cancer patients each year with technology and cancer-fighting care options. More at texasoncology.com.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The city of Dallas will not be liable for an off-duty police officer shooting a man in his own apartment last year. A federal judge on Monday dismissed Dallas from a civil lawsuit brought by the family of Botham Jean, who was killed by former officer Amber Geiger. She's serving a 10-year prison sentence for his murder. The lawsuit against her argues better police training could have prevented Jean's death. Texas Congressman Lloyd Doggett is urging Republicans in the U.S. Senate to keep an open mind about Donald Trump's impeachment trial. On CNN Thursday, the Austin Democrat said he's pleased GOP Senator Lisa Murkowski spoke out against coordination between the White House and Senate Republicans.
I think it's rather noteworthy that just the fact that one Republican senator says that she might want to hear the evidence before making up her mind is newsworthy. That's what you would expect every juror in the Senate to do.
Speaker Nancy Pelosi has delayed sending articles of impeachment to the Senate while seeking assurances the trial will be fair. Research from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finds that the number of babies born in the U.S. with opioids in their systems has increased by more than five times over a 10-year period. Texas Public Radio's Bonnie Petrie explains.
In 2004, 1.5 babies per thousand were born with newborn opioid withdrawal syndrome. By 2014, it was 8 babies per thousand. Lisa Cleveland is an associate professor at UT Health San Antonio School of Nursing. Those numbers don't surprise her, and she hopes they will inspire conversations about how best to care for these babies, and it includes their mothers.
Traditionally, there's sort of been the sense that the healthcare system kind of has to protect these newborns from their mothers, which is really the opposite of what needs to be happening. We need to be involving mom and the baby's care.
One third of all the babies born in Texas with newborn opioid withdrawal syndrome are born in Bexar County. I'm Bonnie Petrie in San Antonio.
College football's bowl season takes on a Texas flavor over the next few days. KERA's Rick Holter breaks down the schedule.
There'll be five bowls in Texas in the next 5 days. Tonight in Houston, Texas A&M and Oklahoma State face off in the Texas Bowl. It's the first time they've met since A&M left for the Southeastern Conference in 2012. Tomorrow in Arlington, the Cotton Bowl hosts Penn State and Memphis. Monday brings Western Kentucky and Western Michigan to the First Responder Bowl in Dallas. And New Year's Eve delivers El Paso's Sun Bowl with Arizona State against Florida State and the Alamo Bowl in San Antonio with number 11 Utah against unranked Texas. In Dallas, I'm Rick Holter.
And I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
It's 33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. When a child is diagnosed with a mental illness, parents can play a crucial role in their treatment. But what happens when those children are no longer children and turn into adults? KERA series The Caregivers spotlights North Texans navigating the challenges of care. It's part of a mental health project called On Our Minds. In this chapter, Saida Hassan explores how one Fort Worth mother is caring for her adult son with schizophrenia and the legal hurdles tripping her up.
It's a Sunday morning in November, and Debbie Spruill is wearing a black and white striped dress to match her fellow choir members at the Straightway Christian Church in Burleson. They join in song as the congregation files in. It's been a tough morning. Before Debbie left home, her son, Jermaine Haley, wasn't in a good state of mind, and they had a disagreement. Debbie is a Fort Worth native and a caregiver to 30-year-old Jermaine. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia about 10 years ago. Symptoms can be managed with treatment and can include hearing voices, having hallucinations, and a lack of pleasure in everyday life.
He is never compliant with his medication once he gets out of the hospital. He goes in and out several times a year, and when he gets out, he never takes his medicine again until he goes back.
Much of the past 10 years have looked like this for Debbie. Jermaine's been committed to mental health facilities across North Texas, usually for 90-day stints. When he's released, he comes back to Debbie's house.
When he first gets out of the hospital, he's primarily doing pretty good, but after that, as he starts to decline, he's not able to take care of himself or fix himself anything to eat.
Debbie works full-time to support the two of them, but she's getting older, and it's getting harder. At times, Jermaine has torn things up around the house. Debbie has tried to get him into some group homes, but he never wants to stay. When she's home, Debbie spends a lot of time alone.
I have to stay locked in my room most of the time, depending on how he is.
She passes the time reading or watching crime procedurals on TV.
If he is having a pretty good day, then I'm able to come out, straighten up. But if he is not, then most of the time I go and get him something to eat and I stay back in my room and try to stay out of his way.
Despite being his caregiver, Debbie can't force Jermaine to take his medication or make any concrete decisions about his care. That's because he's a legal adult with his own rights.
Debbie has a problem that's sadly typical to Texas law, which is that she's falling in this gap within the laws.
Matthew Burke is an attorney with the Johnson firm in Dallas. He says Texas offers some legal remedies for people like Debbie and Jermaine. Debbie could seek a medical power of attorney, but Jermaine could revoke the agreement. There's the option to seek a guardianship, a more permanent legal tool, which could allow Debbie to decide where Jermaine lives, who he sees, and what type of treatment he receives. But that would also mean stripping Jermaine of basic rights, which is why the state of Texas says guardianship should be the last and best available choice. It's expensive, and applications have to be filed with a court.
In addition to the financial toll, the time toll, there's often a deep and harmful emotional toll on all the parties involved.
4 years ago, state lawmakers introduced a new tool called a supported decision-making agreement. It's meant to be a less extreme alternative, allowing adults to appoint someone to make certain choices for them without going through the courts. But even if Jermaine and Debbie signed off on an agreement, the concept is still pretty new.
So when you hand one of those over to an institution like a hospital or a bank, they're probably going to look at it quizzically and not really know what to do with it.
Let the church say amen. Come on, let the church say amen. Amen.
Debbie Spruill isn't certain of her next steps.
Getting support from friends, family, loved ones, church members is very important, because if I didn't have people like praying for me, I wouldn't be able to make it.
Back at the Straightway Christian Church, assistant pastor Dorothy Hines tells the story of Job, a biblical figure who remained faithful even when challenged by the devil himself.
The good thing about it, kind of like Job, he can do what he wants to, but he still can't touch me.
In a few moments, Debbie will return home to her duties as a caregiver. But for now, she closes her eyes, raises her hands, and says, Hallelujah. I'm Saida Hassan in Dallas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas ABLE program, a tax advantage savings program helping eligible Texans with disabilities save for the future. Learn more, including how the program works with certain public benefits, at texasable.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, launching Lead On, a campaign for TCU, with a $1 billion goal to support people and programs striving to make a positive impact on the world. TCU, Lead On.
My name is Shahed, and this is where I'm from. I'm from the scary sound still in my ear. The sound of the bomb 100 yards from my house. I am from running from my house to the dark cave, a place where my family and I hide for our lives. I am from watching the red bomb explode in the nearby buildings covering our ears, the ground shaking. I am from feeling scared and crying when I heard the yells and cries, from seeing things no one should see. I am from having to be strong even when there were people being shot for protesting. I am from Syria, and my heart's still there. I am Shahed Salhab, and you are listening to the Texas Standard.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm Joy Diaz in for David Brown. And if you're not familiar with the story of Henry Lee Lucas, also known as the One-Eyed Drifter, you need to know that his story has a lot of Texas in it. First, Lucas was arrested in 1984 in Montague County, Texas. He confessed to killing his 15-year-old common law wife and another woman. But after his conviction, he asked the court what they were going to do about the 100 other women he had killed. And those words unleashed a frenzy from law enforcement agencies all over the country to see if they could, by any chance, charged Lucas with a long list of unsolved crimes. Lucas's story was captured in the documentary called Confession Killer. It's airing now on Netflix, and we are joined by the filmmakers, Robert Kenner and Taki Oldham. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
I wanted to ask, which one of you was first connected to the Lucas story? Who was attracted to this story first?
In about 2014, I saw a documentary from the early 2000s that finished with the question, if Henry Lee Lucas did not kill all of these 200 people as he was claiming, then who did? And are the killers still out there? Mm. And at that time, it was seen to be an unanswerable question. And a lot of law enforcement was still maintaining that he was guilty. Others had changed their status of cases and reopened them. And obviously time had passed and DNA had become available. Long story short, none of the cases that were being solved using DNA were linking to Lucas, and a number of them were finding other killers, and in some cases those killers had continued to kill after Lucas had taken credit for their crimes.
And so that answer was by Tacky Oldham. Robert, talk to me a little bit about this, because I'm very curious. You guys knew the story going in. So what actually surprised you as you were doing your own research and as you were filming your own story?
Yeah, it's a five-part series on Netflix, and it was an amazing tale. And this is a story with just one surprise after another, and it sort of was jaw-dropping. And I think what was most interesting for us is that people saw in Henry what they wanted to see. So here was this drifter with a low IQ who was now accused of hundreds of murders and confessing to hundreds of murders and having knowledge about so much of this, but yet it turns out to not be true in many, many, many cases. And why these cases weren't being reopened seemed really, you know, of interest. And we felt as much as possible to show that these cases need to be reopened was the challenge for us in making this series.
And, you know, when you were talking about DNA, of course, now we can, you know, prove some things with DNA. But even back then, there were things that didn't make sense. The same person cannot kill somebody in Florida and then somebody else in Texas within hours. Or, you know, there were clues that would tell you that this man was lying. Tacky, do you want to talk about that? Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes when a person's telling you they committed a crime and you really want to solve that crime, and this is in the days when we didn't have all the technology we do now to track someone's GPS, their movements, we didn't have the levels of forensic evidence we did, then someone's confession held a lot more weight. And so I think ultimately every police person, or at least the vast, vast majority, went in there with the best of intentions, believing Lucas's confession. And it really was only the ones who were particularly skeptical were looking beyond the confession to find the problems that you're talking about, the fact that Lucas couldn't be in two places at once.
Mm-hmm. Do you at all feel responsible for the fact that some of these cases are being reopened?
Well, we certainly contacted a lot of police agencies and to find out the status of the cases, what cases were opened, what cases were still closed, whether killers had been found, whether evidence existed. And in our doing that, we certainly made various presentations to police agencies who were unaware that Lucas had recanted or that evidence had come to light that he couldn't have been in that state or that location at that time because evidence had put him somewhere else. So certainly in those cases, we were giving the police the opportunity to reopen those cases, and then often they did that, and other times they didn't. And they said, we prefer to keep the case closed because we have a confession and we're sticking to it.
Hmm. I read a quote that said, a quote from Lucas where he said, I'm not going to stop confessing just because they gave me the death penalty already. You know, they can only kill me once. So that was his attitude.
Well, Lucas's attitude changed over time. And you see footage in our series where Lucas, having been accused of hundreds of murders, and he's sitting in the Ranger Task Force office answering phones, putting pins in the map, grabbing coffee out of the hands of the Rangers, no handcuffs on, feeling very, very pleased and feeling like he was just a member of the team solving problems. That was probably the happiest time of his life. But then at some point, Lucas recants to all these murders. And it's just, it's really quite a psychological tale how people, everyone around Lucas is seeing what they want in this very blank slate. He's ready to go in any direction. He's sort of what you call a confabulator, because he will say something and believe it, and everyone wants him to say what they want him to say.
Filmmaker Robert Kenner and filmmaker Taki Oldham, thank you so much to both of you.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
They captured the story of Henry Lee Lucas in a series airing on Netflix right now called Confession Killer.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund and the Texas College Savings Plan, administered by the state of Texas. More on how each plan can help families start saving for future college expenses is at savenowforcollege.org.
I am Jody Edgerton, and I'm with the Typewriter Rodeo. And we are a group that crafts custom poems on vintage typewriters. You give us a word, an idea, a phrase, something you'd like a poem about, and we will write you a poem on the spot. Hanukkah in Texas. We gather our family and welcome our friends, sharing stories of long, long ago, when the oil that shouldn't have lasted a day lasted 8 days, surprising us so. Now all across Texas, one new flame each night, celebrating with clear, grateful hearts, how all of us still get to share that great miracle of the light that proclaimed a new start. So find a new friend, spin a dreidel, win some gelt, Hanukkah's perfect chocolate treat, it's true. Then tuck in for a good hearty Hanukkah meal, potato latkes, and brisket. Choose your favorite local barbecue. I'm Jody Edgerton, and you're on Texas Standard Time.
Support for the Typewriter Radio comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org.
And you can find the Typewriter Rodeo here each Friday and anytime on your favorite podcast platform. You know, we're always collecting ideas for poems on social media and at texasstandard.org, so send us yours. It's Friday, the last Friday of 2019, and that means that, yes, even during the holidays, we'll close out the show discussing the week that was in Texas politics. Joining us now is the Texas Tribune's political reporter, Alex Samuels. Alex, welcome back.
Yes, of course. Thanks for having me.
So now we know that Beto O'Rourke is not running for president, and he won't challenge John Cornyn for a Senate seat, but he will be involved in the 2020 election. So tell us how.
Right. So Beto launched a new political group to help boost Texas Democrats in the 2020 election. That group is called Powered by People, and it works sort of like a PAC.
And what is his role going to be in it?
I think the goal is for him to have more of a backseat role after this next election cycle. But him and I believe his wife is involved, too. The goal is to bring together volunteers from around the state to work on what he calls the most important races in Texas. So in particular, I think he has his eye on the fight for the Texas State House majority. National Democrats have been working to flip six Texas congressional seats, and then, of course, the race to unseat John Cornyn.
Let's talk about Speaker of the House, Dennis Bonin. And we have news that he likely violated state law during a meeting this summer with conservative activist Michael Quinn Sullivan. Remind us, how did he do that?
So I think what the committee said is that he likely agreed to a section of the Texas government code, which deals with bribery. Basically, it deals with accepting or soliciting any gifts or favors that might reasonably influence the officer or employee. So I think what they were talking about there is exchanging media credentials for Bonin, or for Bonin asking Michael Quinn Sullivan to help, I think his word was, pop 10 House members.
Knowing that, does that mean that he could face some sort of additional legal trouble, Bonin, that is?
I think the House General Investigation Committee said that the investigation was closed. So I think the committee's work there is done. But it's interesting. I think there's still more that could be done. As we noted in our story, further action now is kind of up to the entire 150-member lower chamber. So that General Investigation Committee can propose articles of impeachment, but I think it's definitely worth noting that they did not do so during that hearing that happened, I believe, last week. And so if House members wanted to act on these articles of impeachment, they have three vehicles of doing so, one of which includes the governor issuing a proclamation to bring the House back into session.
Alex, I read a very interesting article that you wrote about, you know, your time, spending time in the suburbs, talking to Republican women about the 2020 campaign. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So I went to a Women for Trump event where they held sort of a panel discussion talking about some of the best things that they believe President Trump has done in his first 3.5 years of his presidency, and then talked about how they could get women involved in 2020. It was definitely interesting. That event was in Houston, kind of right outside the suburbs, where we're seeing that message, that pro-Trump message, may be a tougher sell. We did a University of Texas, Texas Tribune poll earlier this year, and it said that a majority of women would definitely vote for someone besides Trump in 2020 in the general election, and that 4 to 6 people living in the suburbs would said the same thing. So it's interesting to see these women turning out for Trump so enthusiastically in a place where that message may be a tougher sell.
And trying to motivate others. Alex Samuels is a political reporter for the Texas Tribune. Alex, thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, of course. Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to the Texas Standard. He's Michael Marks, and he's in for Wells Dunbar. He is our social media editor, and I am very curious, what are Texans talking about on this, the last Friday of the month, the year, the decade?
Man, it's a lot to top. Well, we got cut short, a little short, earlier in the show, talking about Simone Biles, the Texan gymnast who the Associated Press just named their 2019 Female Athlete of the Year. So real quick, thought I would highlight this tweet in which the Dallas Morning News editorial board calls Biles the greatest athlete Texas has ever seen. That's quite a statement.
There is a lot of pride.
Quite a statement. But she certainly has an argument. If she's not our state's greatest athlete yet, she's got a chance to solidify her spot at the 2020 Summer Olympics in Tokyo. Mm-hmm. I predict we may be having the same conversation next year.
Did you say predict?
I said predict. Aww. And speaking of predictions, before leaving for the holiday break, Wells, as you mentioned, the guy who usually sits in this chair, he threw this question out on the Texas Standard Facebook page. What are your predictions, political and otherwise, for 2020? Mm-hmm. Quite a few responses. Unfortunately, many of them deeply cynical, albeit perhaps reasonable. I thought I'd bring a few to the airwaves. Blake Fowler opines that come Election Day 2020, unless Democrats put forward a viable candidate like Bernie, some opinion there, Trump will win 2020.
Editorial.
Democrats will keep the House and Republicans will keep the Senate in 2020. In Corpus Christi, Peter Moore predicts a more tumultuous new year from a political perspective. He writes that Trump will not be convicted by the Senate. Trump will win re-election, the Republican Party splits, and we see the biggest shift in American politics since realignment from FDR to LBJ. So that's a pretty big prediction. Marcos Gonzalez says that he believes 2020 will be a year of clarity, whatever that means. I hope it comes true. And Cody Nethery doesn't go too far out on a limb. He believes that the Cowboys won't be in the Super Bowl. Doesn't appear they'll even be in the playoffs, Cody, so hope you didn't pull a muscle with that big reach of a prediction. Would love to hear other people's predictions.
It is always fun to speculate about those things. And you know what? On behalf of everyone on The Standard, Rhonda Fanning, Laura Rice, Terry Langford, Wells Dunbar, Michael Marks, Kristen Cabrera, Jill Amond, Alexa Hart, Caroline Covey.
Carolyn Cummings.
Casey Cheek, thank you. Leah Scarpelli, Shelley Brisbane, Becky Fogle, Joseph Leahy, and of course, David Brown. I'm Joy Diaz, wishing you a happy, happy weekend.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Waldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington family. Would your company or organization like to be a sponsor as well? Contact your local station for opportunities within your community. For statewide sponsorships, visit TexasPublicMediaNetwork.com.